The physicalist, the person who says that there is nothing other than matter about you, you're comprised completely, 100% of matter, and that's all there is to you. That's a physicalist. And the physicalist says that there's no soul, and so a zygote can't be human, because when they look at a zygote, when they look at a fertilized egg, it doesn't look very human. They look at it and they say, well, it's not shaped like a human, it's not large enough to be human, and so it's not human. But it's not your body that makes you human. If I go on, and it's so easy to illustrate, if I go on a diet and lose 10 pounds, does that mean that I'm only 90% human after losing or if I lose 10% of my body weight? No, of course not. I'm still just as human as ever. I'm even human if I cut off one of my hands. Your body, this is an interesting thing I didn't know. Your body is composed entirely of atoms. I mean, I knew that. Your body is an arrangement of about 10 to the 27th power of atoms. Guess how many of those atoms that make up your body were present 7 years ago? The atoms that are in your body right now, guess how many of them were present 7 years ago in your body? The answer? Zero. Every single one has been replaced in the last 7 years. And some people think it's a lot less than 7 years. 98% of them are replaced every year. So physically, there's nothing present in your body right now that was there 7 years ago. You are completely different physically. Different matter. However, you're still the same person, right? And society recognizes that. We put a murderer on trial, and the murder trial goes 7 years. After 7 years, the guy says, hey, look, sure, that body, that group of atoms that made up my body 7 years ago committed that murder, but I'm not guilty because I'm a completely different conglomeration of atoms. What would we say? We would say, we're not trying the atoms. The atoms are on trial. You are on trial. You, the person. And so there's got to be some you that survives the changes of your body. So what is it? What is the you? If it's not the physical matter, what is it? Is it your mind? Some people say, well, it's your mind. But that has problems too. When you do experiments on people where they numb half of their brain, which hinders the function of the mind, that doesn't make the person subhuman. The person's still just as human as ever. What makes you human is the fact that you are a human soul. And anyone who has a human soul is 100% human. You've probably been taught that it's your... Here's another interesting thing that I learned. You've probably been taught that it's your DNA that causes your development. That's what I've always thought. That's not true. It's not your DNA that causes your body to develop. All the information needed for your development is present in your DNA, but that information has to be put into use by something else, by some other driver. DNA molecules are not self-starters. The French geneticist Francis Jacob points this out. He says, quote, outside the cell, without the means to carry out the plans, without the apparatus necessary for copying or transmitting the genetic program, remains inert. No more than memory of a computer can the memory of heredity act in isolation. Able to function only within the cell, the genetic message can do nothing by itself. It can only guide what is being done. It needs a driver. And the driver that takes the information in the DNA and puts it into action, tells it what to do, and starts the whole thing going, is the soul. Which means the soul is present and fully functional right at the moment that the body begins developing, which is at conception. And I told you last time, just sprung this on you at the very end last time, you can think of the relationship between the soul and the body as being like the relationship between a person and a computer that he's building. And the person is like the soul and the computer is like the body. And if your only interaction with such a person which is through, say, email, then at the early stages of him building his computer, you have no contact whatsoever, and he seems like he doesn't exist. And then as he develops some kind of crude, barely functional modem and writes some real simplistic software, maybe he can send you some cryptic message on email, and he seems like he's barely existing. And then as he develops the computer more, his communication gets to be more and more sophisticated. But the person was a full-blown person the whole time. That's kind of the way it is for a developing human being. The body, developing body, is kind of like that computer, but the soul is the person. And he's all 100% there from the very beginning. The same principle holds true for mental development. It's not the mental functioning or ability that makes you human. And I can illustrate that. I have as a human being the inherent capacity to speak 5 languages. But I never learned more than 1. So does that make me 20% human? Since I haven't realized those inherent capacities, human capacities I have? Since I haven't put them into practice? No. You can have a capacity and never put it into practice, and that doesn't make you less human. Humanness has nothing to do with how developed you are or what abilities you have. And to help you understand that, I got to point out the difference between abilities and capacities. And those are just for lack of better terms. As a human being, I have the capacity for language, which means I have the capacity for speaking multiple languages. However, right now I only have the ability to speak English. Lack of ability can prevent capacities, higher order capacities, from being realized, but the capacity still exists. Just because you don't have the ability doesn't mean you don't have the capacity. For example, when you're asleep, you don't have the ability to do much of anything, right? You might have the ability to only do about 5% of the things that you have the ability to do when you're awake. But does that mean that you're only 5% human when you're asleep? No, you're still fully human. Because the capacities remain, because the soul is just as human as it ever was. If you cut off both my legs, I no longer have the ability to walk, but I still have that higher order capacity to walk. I just don't have the ability. Does that make sense? If someone's in a coma and a persistent vegetative state, he's lost most of his abilities, but he's still a human soul because he has the same capacities. The next time you talk to somebody who's a strict physicalist and who thinks that all that exists is matter and there's no immaterial part to us and there's no spiritual world or immaterial world, challenge that person to come up with a definition of humanness, what makes you human, that will work when you apply it to somebody under general anesthesia and they still come out being human. Anyone who's pro-abortion, you ask them what determines humanness, when is a person valuable enough that we shouldn't kill him, and when they give an answer, this is what makes a person human, and they'll talk about conscious awareness or whatever, apply that to somebody under general anesthesia and you end up saying that as soon as someone's under general anesthesia, they're not human. Yeah, a person in a vegetative state is just as human as anyone else. A frozen embryo is just as human as anyone else.
How would you apply that to people who say that you're not human until you're alive? I mean, like with a beating heart.
Yeah. Right, until the heart starts beating. It's arbitrary. I mean, if they say that, I guess this isn't a foolproof test. If you gave this test to them, then the person who's under general anesthesia would still pass. But there's other problems with that. So I see why you bring that up, because you're right. This won't dismiss every possible argument or definition of humanness from the pro-abortion people. However, when they give you something like that, it ends up being arbitrary. Why the heart? And how functional does the heart have to be? How developed does it have to be? And if there's a problem with your heart, then does that make you partially human? Like if I know somebody who has heart trouble and part of his heart is dead and doesn't function quite right, does that mean he's only half human and his life is only half as valuable as someone else, and then I can kill him if I want to? So. Yeah, that whole viability thing is really, really, you end up having children not being human because a fetus isn't viable, a child isn't viable. You take a little 2-year-old and put him out in the woods by himself, he'll die. You know, so nobody's viable. Everybody needs help at some point. You're right. We're all dependent. So, good. But if you think of somebody under anesthesia, you don't have consciousness. You're not sentient. You have no ability to communicate. You have no self-awareness. And you have no ability to respond to your environment. All those things can't be the definition for humans. Also, if what makes you is just matter, then you're not the same human being that you were when you were 5 or even 7 years ago. And as we saw, there has to be some you that survives over those changes. And Scripture affirms that. David talks about himself in the womb. He's the same him. He's the same guy. Even though all the changes that his body's gone through hasn't changed who he is. That constant is what makes you human. All right. Now, let me go through a few of the common arguments for why people argue for the superior value of the mother's life over the life of the... How the soul arrives is a matter of debate. Some people say that it's passed on from the parents, and some people say it's created right at the moment of conception. But it doesn't really matter to me. I don't know why there's even a debate about that, because I don't see why it matters. It's just so that we understand that the soul is present as soon as the egg is fertilized. And so whether God does that by means of special creation or by some natural means is kind of irrelevant. But the soul, but just so you know, whenever there's conditions for a human being, whenever you have either a fertilized egg or a divided fertilized egg, that's when the soul comes into existence. So I believe that right at the moment of conception, the soul comes into existence. And then in the case, in the somewhat rare case of an egg that divides after having been fertilized by one sperm, then right at, it's just one soul, and then as soon as it divides, then another soul comes into being. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into cloning. But I just want to go through the common arguments for the superior value of a mother's life so that we can see the folly of them. Pro-abortion people have given these again and again. You can see them in their literature all the time. Why the mother's life is more valuable than that of the fetus. And then the number one is freedom of choice. By far the most common is freedom of choice. That's why they call themselves pro-choice. The developing child might be a living human person, but the mother's right to make choices regarding her own body is more important than the baby's life. The problem with that argument is even most abortionists would agree that a mother, once she becomes a mother, is no longer free to behave as a non-mother. If you have children, but you behave as a non-mother, you're going to be prosecuted for child abuse or child neglect. It's possible in life to make choices that limit future choices, right? When I was single, I had the freedom to just decide to go off by myself and just take off for a few days somewhere. But if Teresa and I did that when our kids were babies, they'd put us in jail. You can't just do that. You can't just leave. You don't have the freedom to do everything that you used to have the freedom to do if you become a parent. Just ask Kay. She doesn't have the freedom to do anything anymore. Affects all kinds of choice. So the freedom of choice argument fails.
But what about people who kind of shift the idea of freedom of choice that the government shouldn't be legislating that?
Okay, that's a good point. That's a good point. If you didn't hear that, what they're saying is, okay, this whole question about whether or not the fetus or the fertilized egg is a human being is... It's in the realm of philosophy, it's in the realm of theology, it's in the realm of ethics. It shouldn't be something the government dictates. That's not the government's role to come in and tell us what to do with our own families and, you know, inside your own womb and all that. And the same argument that I just gave can be used as a response to that. It's the government. If it's a person, then the argument always falls apart, because you can say the same thing with say, a two-year-old. A two-year-old in your home causes you great inconvenience, and there's a whole lot of laws that apply to how you have to behave if you have a two-year-old in your house. And you say, the question of whether I should be able to just take off and go on a vacation by myself, or my wife and I should just be able to go off on a vacation by ourselves, that's a personal choice, and the government has no business telling me about what to do about vacations. Well, the government will tell you that you can't leave a two-year-old home alone for 2 weeks in your house. And that is a legitimate role of government, because the role of government is to protect the weak from the strong. That's the one major role of government, is to prevent people from punishing people who commit crimes on the weak. And so that applies, if the baby is a person, then it applies to that person as well. That person needs to be protected by the government. So it definitely is the government's role to pass laws to protect. Because if the society doesn't protect the weak, then the weak are left without protection. And no one will stand up for them, especially if their own parents are going to want to kill them. So it's not wrong to pass laws that say you can't kill your children. And if it's not wrong to pass laws to say you can't kill your teenage children or your 3-year-old children or your 5-year-old children, then it's no different passing a law saying you can't kill any other kind of child. So, good point. All right. Secondly, they'll argue that it's a hardship for the poor. Restricting abortion becomes a hardship for poor women because they can't afford to care for the baby. The irony of that is that it's not the poor women who are primary advocates of abortion rights, generally. The truth is, 94% of pro-choice women work. See, it's not that they don't have the money, they just don't want the limitations of parenting on their affluent lifestyle. And like all the other arguments, it becomes meaningless if the unborn child is equal to every other human life. Because we would have to say that the law against killing 4-year-olds discriminates against the poor, right? And the law against killing teenagers really discriminates against the poor because they're even more expensive, right? I mean, what poor person can afford a teenager? So you can see the folly of these arguments as soon as you realize it's a human person. Number 3, the mother's mental health. And that argument is the argument that our government used to justify abortion when they legalized it in Roe v. Wade. And the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, they said that abortion is justifiable only if it's necessary to preserve the health of the mother. And so, now if they said it's only justifiable to save the life of the mother, then it wouldn't be as extreme an error. Let's talk about that for just a moment. When the woman's life is in danger, is it ethical to abort a baby if the woman's life is in danger? And there's two possibilities there. Number one, it's a situation like a tubal pregnancy where if the baby's not aborted, both mother and baby will die. And number two is a situation where the mother's life is at risk and the doctor can either save one or the other, but not both. So let's talk about those two. The first case, I don't see anything wrong with killing the baby if doing so is going to save the mother and not doing so, they both die. Because doing nothing is the equivalent to killing two people, whereas if you do something, you can at least save one. So I think if you can save one, you should. The second case is a little harder. But, you know, I got to tell you, I wonder how often that really happens. The situation where the doctor has to decide either save the mother's life or the baby's life. Because if it does happen, then I would say it's a judgment call that has to be made by this individual particular circumstance. Because medical issues are very rarely that cut and dried. Usually it's more an issue of percentages. And so if the doctor says, well, there might be a 20% chance of the mother dying if you don't abort the baby, and only a 10% chance of her dying otherwise, and then those numbers are guesses, you know, then that makes everything a lot fuzzier. And if you put it in those terms, I think it's worth taking a risk to save a life. Every situation is different, and I'm sure I don't think there's a rigid rule that can be applied across the board on those things. But as long as you understand that the baby is a person and as valuable as any other person, then I think your judgment call is going to tend to be right if you're generally wise. So anyway, that's all when the mother's life is in danger. But this whole issue of when the mother's health is in danger, that's what Roe v. Wade said. If her health is in danger, then it's okay to abort the baby. And then in another decision that same court decided, right after Roe v. Wade, they said that included in the health of the mother is her mental well-being. Which is why even the healthiest woman in the world with the healthiest pregnancy in the world can still get an abortion under the law of the land in the United States, because all she has to say is that her pregnancy is causing her some mental distress or anxiety. And then her mental health is in danger, and so it's okay. But if they're genuinely concerned about psychological damage being done to the mother, they're not going to protect her from that by killing her baby. Studies indicate far higher incidence of psychological harm to those who choose abortion than those who choose to give birth. There's just no question, you can't question that. In fact, threats of suicide are extremely high among women who have had an abortion, but women who remain pregnant almost never commit suicide. In fact, I thought this was interesting, the suicide rate among pregnant mothers is 1/6 the rate among non-pregnant women the same age, just regular women. That means if you are just a regular woman who's not pregnant, you are 6 times more likely to kill yourself than a woman your age who is pregnant. So it's pretty tough to make an argument for abortion based on protecting the mother's psychological health. Even pro-abortion advocates admit the existence and prevalence of what psychologists call post-abortion syndrome. They disagree on how to treat it. They disagree on what causes it. But everyone agrees that it exists, which is the negative psychological aftermath of abortion. So that argument fails. Fourth, the conscious awareness of interests argument. I'll just quickly go through this. Some people say that the value of the life of the unborn is not there because a conscious awareness of your interests is required in order for you to be a person. And other people, if you don't have conscious awareness of your own interests, then other people aren't responsible, don't have the responsibility to do things that are in your interest. So in other words, in order to have best interests, you have to be able to have an interest in your interests. So we have no obligation to do what's in the best interest of the fetus since the fetus doesn't have any interests. That's the argument. Now, let me give you a scenario that shows the folly of that. Imagine a newborn child, a child's already been born and was born unconscious. And the part of the higher brain that controls consciousness has been damaged, but the rest of the brain functions just fine, which means the heartbeat and respiration, digestion, everything's normal. Now imagine that there's a treatment that they have that will regenerate the damaged brain tissue and restore the higher brain function and allow the baby to become conscious and fully aware and normal and just like every other newborn baby in the nursery. If the treatment is given to the baby, that baby will develop normally and won't have any problems, be just like every other baby. Now, isn't it obvious in a situation like that such a treatment would be in the baby's best interests? Even though the baby has no awareness of his interests because he's not conscious? And isn't it true that if such a treatment existed, you would be doing the child a great wrong by denying him that treatment? So someone can have interests even if they're not aware of their interests. Now, if that's the case, think of the fetus, who doesn't even need any treatment. All he needs is not to be killed, just no intervention at all, and he'll turn out fine. He just needs the same thing you need, nourishment. That's it. So there can be interests even without awareness of interest. And then the fifth argument is wantedness. The pro-abortion people say an unwanted child is better off not to exist. Again, all you have to do to show the error of that is to think of the child as a human being. If you have a 4-year-old or a spouse that you don't want, you're not allowed to kill him. Much to the chagrin of some people I know, but is my value as a human being really tied to how much people want me? Based on how many times I've been fired, I would say that there's plenty of people out there that don't want me. Does that mean it's okay to kill me? That's the attitude of Nazi Germany, and I think we would see that if we just traded the word wanted for desired. If we said, instead of saying unwanted, we said undesirable, then we could see this. Those words mean the same thing, right? Unwanted, undesirable, means basically, essentially the same thing. The Nazis said, let's just kill the undesirables. We say, let's just kill the unwanted. What's the difference? Just because you don't want a child doesn't mean you have the right to kill a child, and it's very debatable anyway whether there's such a thing as an unwanted child in the United States. With so many people lined up for adoption, trying to adopt a child, especially American newborns. I think you can safely say every child is wanted in the United States. But what they argue is that if the child is unwanted by his birth parents, he's more likely to be abused. And that justifies it, right? Because it's better to be killed than abused, right? And once again, if that's the case, what should we do? Kill all the abused children, right? If that's really true. If the unborn child is a human being who's equal in value to the other human beings, then every one of these arguments collapses. And it's not proven anyway whether unwanted children are more likely to be abused. I don't think that's true. In fact, there's some evidence, there's plenty of evidence for just the opposite. In an atmosphere that allows the killing of unborn children, it seems to cultivate an increased willingness to abuse children. Because before Roe versus Wade, the pro-abortion people told us, look, abortion on demand is going to reduce child abuse down to just about nothing. Because every child will be a wanted child. And if we just kill these children, then they won't get abused. And in the decade following that decision, 15 million unwanted children were aborted. And so now there's 15 million unwanted children that are dead. Did that solve the problem of child abuse? No. During that decade, child abuse skyrocketed 400%. If the killing of the unborn does anything, it creates an environment of more hostility toward children, not less. And one study showed that 90% of battered children are from planned pregnancies. So, if you bring someone into existence and you don't want him, the solution is not to destroy him. The solution is to work towards changing your heart so that you do want him. And God will help you with that. If you're willing to desire the child, I mean, if you have a baby and you don't have a desire for that baby, but you're willing for your desires to change, you're going to find that once the baby is born, God can change your desires. Now, don't raise your hands, but I think it'd be interesting to find out how many mothers in this room have carried a child in their wombs and went through a period of time of not wanting that child. I think if we were honest, there would be a lot of hands. Based on how many people have confided that in me and told that to me, I think there's a lot more than you realize of mothers who had a child that they didn't want for some time. And in every case I know of, once the baby came, the desires came. Because of the willingness of the woman to have God move on her emotions. And so I think that if a person trusts God and just prays for those desires, it's just the same thing as you just desire for anything else. You desire for your spouse. You get to a point where you don't desire your spouse. And the solution isn't to kill your spouse. The solution is to pray and ask God to... Sometimes you lose your desire for God. And you just ask God to regenerate those desires. Okay. All right, now let me just... Oh, it's already 12, huh? No, it's not. The clock is on. Oh, I'm looking at the wrong hand. Oh, sorry. Okay. A couple more minutes. Let's just quick get into fertility issues. A question came last week about egg and sperm donation and surrogate motherhood. I never did answer that question. Let's get into that now. It's amazing to me that the abortion industry flourishes and thrives, and the infertility industry also flourishes and thrives at the same time. While millions of people are killing their children, millions of others are desperately trying to conceive children and can't. I just got a prayer request, I think it was last week, where somebody said, pray for us. We've been trying to conceive for a year and we can't do it. And so that's a major issue. And the methods used in the infertility clinics raise ethical questions, primarily in two areas. One, the destruction of human embryos, and two, the idea of a third party being involved in you bearing a child. So let's talk about those. First, embryos. If you go to an infertility clinic and say, we want to conceive, they have one goal, and that is to bring about the conception of a baby, and they'll do whatever it takes. In fact, there are some infertility clinics now that are offering guarantees, a money-back guarantee that you'll conceive. That is bad, because as soon as they start doing that, then they are not going to concern themselves with any ethical issues. They're just going to do everything they can to bring about the birth of a child. And to achieve that, what they do is they harvest and fertilize as many eggs as they can, numerous eggs. They don't just take one, because it's an expensive and invasive process to harvest an egg, and so they, as long as they're in there, they'll take a bunch. And then they fertilize them all, and then they implant some of those fertilized eggs into the woman's uterus, and the rest are stored. And if it works out, then they're just eventually destroyed. Very often couples will not... It's interesting. A lot of times couples will tell the clinic, don't give these embryos to someone else. Because they're uncomfortable with the idea of someone else, some stranger, raising their child. So they say destroy them instead. So it's ironic, because the embryos are simultaneously precious and worthless to that couple. Sometimes clinics will implant more embryos than a mother could safely carry. They'll put a whole bunch in her and see, you know, try and get one to take, and then just to improve the statistical chance. And then if too many of them survive, then they just abort the extras. Now, based on what we've established in prior classes, we know it's wrong to destroy human embryos because they have human souls. And for that reason, I think we should oppose all that kind of practice, and I think we should oppose embryo research or research that requires the destruction of embryos. Somebody might argue, look, they're going to be created anyway. Those embryos are going to be created by the fertility clinics anyway, and they're going to be destroyed anyway. Why not use them and try and research them and figure out what we can figure out? And the answer is the research industry encourages the creation of more embryos. It finances it, and so it shares in the guilt. If you're a researcher and you give money to the clinic that keeps on creating excess embryos, you're funding the immoral activity. Now, the other part, donation. If you donate eggs or sperm for someone else to become pregnant, is that adulterous? Let's start by thinking through what makes adultery wrong. One thing that makes it wrong is lust. Another thing that makes adultery wrong is the unfaithfulness and the breach of your vows. And the third thing that makes adultery wrong is that in adultery, you become one flesh with someone besides your spouse. Now, in the case of donation of eggs or sperm, the first two are not an issue. It's not an issue of lust, and it's not an issue of unfaithfulness. But I think there's some question about the third one. When God promised Abraham a son, and Abraham decided Sarah's servant was going to be a surrogate, God was not pleased with that. Now, he didn't do that out of lust or unfaithfulness, but it was still wrong. And the question is it wrong just because God wanted it to be clear that the baby was going to be born in a miraculous way, or was it also wrong because Abraham was seeking a child by means outside of the God-ordained means? And I think it's both. If you're infertile, there's nothing wrong with getting treatment, and there's nothing wrong with adopting, but using donor sperm seems like, in one sense, you're becoming one flesh with someone else. And I think it's ethically questionable. I can't categorically say it's wrong. I just think it's ethically questionable. And we should really think it through before we do that. And as for surrogate motherhood, that's a little different because you get both the sperm and the egg came from you and your partner, but you borrow someone else's womb. I think there's still possible ethical problem of seeking to have a child through a third party. It just seems to me that if a woman can't bear a child, that condition is not, if it's not medically reversible, that's a sign, I think, that it's not God's will for you to naturally have children except through adoption. Right, the closing of the womb and the inability to conceive is always presented in Scripture as something that God is doing for a purpose and so on. It's not presented more like a sickness, in the same category as a sickness. It's not always a punishment. Sometimes it's just a test, just like other trials. It's not necessarily a punishment, like in the case of Sarah, you know, or something. It's more a test than a punishment. But it can be a punishment. The question is why isn't surrogate motherhood in the same category as adoption? Like I say, it's a judgment call that I think a person needs to make kind of on their own. My own personal thought on it is, I'm not sure I can explain why I see it as a different thing, and I wouldn't, if somebody did that, I wouldn't tell them that they were in sin, because it is a lot like adoption. But I guess I can't say for sure that it's wrong. However, I can say this, that there are some wisdom issues to take into consideration as well. God designed women to be attached to the babies that they carry and give birth to, and it's questionable whether it's wise to allow another woman to carry your baby and to give birth to your baby because of the extreme distress that could be caused by the separation after the baby is born. And it's a little presumptuous for you to think, oh, it'll be fine, that won't be a problem, because you don't know. And so, unless you've done it before, you know. So I think that there's some wisdom issues at hand as well. Injections of just fertility drugs that help them conceive? Okay. I don't have a problem with that. I think if you know, sometimes you hear about those fertility drugs causing so many multiples of twins that they end up aborting some of them and things like that, and that I would disagree with. But I don't have a problem with medical intervention to help a person conceive.
I did a bunch of infertility and could never get pregnant, and then got pregnant and had two kids right in a row. Maybe we get impatient, so we take these fertility drugs and everything, because, you know, we're going to conceive, and then we say we conceived because we took them.
Right.
Maybe God just created that baby in his own time.
That's right. Yeah, I really think there's so much to be said for what Debbie said. The Lord, God is always the Lord of the womb, all the way through Scripture. He opened and closed the womb. And there's a lot to be said for just trusting the Lord's timing and being content with what He gives and doesn't give. And His ways are higher than ours.